Today is Wednesday, June 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, demonstrations over racial injustice show no signs of letting up as mourners remember Rayshard Brooks.
There's so many ways that Friday, June 12th could have ended.
Dr. Anthony Fauci dispels the idea that the president wants to slow down testing for coronavirus.
It's the opposite. We're going to be doing more testing, not less.
Also ahead, musical artists are the latest to call for anti-racist content. It's all on today's International Edition. The nation's top infectious disease physician appeared before Congress Tuesday as U.S. coronavirus cases surged or set records in a number of U.S. states. Texas reported over 5,000 new cases on Monday, a single-day record for the state. Dr. Anthony Fauci testified before a congressional committee where he expressed concern over the latest spikes. Joining us now for more on the hearing is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, it sounds like Dr. Fauci has some positive news, at least about testing, despite the controversy over President Trump's comments that testing is finding too many infections. What did Dr. Fauci say about it?
Dr. Fauci said that there had been no slowdown whatsoever in testing, and that if anything, the U.S. was actually stepping up testing and testing even more than in the early days of the coronavirus crisis back in March, early April, as many remember, when it was actually quite difficult to get a hold of a coronavirus test here in the United States. Now we're seeing a lot more options for people, including the drive-up testing, a lot of expanded testing at doctors' offices and pharmacies across the United States. And what Dr. Redfield said from the CDC was that they were doing about 500,000 tests. Now, what they do need to do is step up that number to about 900,000 tests a day to be able to get to the number that they need to be at to control and contain this. And of course, we know that there have been some coronavirus hotspots popping up in different states around the country, California, Texas, Arizona. So they really need to get on top of that testing and the contact tracing strategy to be able to contain this and make sure that all of the quarantining and the stay-at-home measures for the past three and a half months will actually work those gains that we have made.
And Dr. Fauci also expressed some concern in the coming days. And of course, we know the president is holding a big rally indoors with a lot of people that are not wearing masks.
Plan A, don't go in a crowd. Plan B, if you do, make sure you wear a mask.
Warning people not to gather indoors in big crowds.
Right now, the next couple of weeks are going to be critical in our ability to address those surgings that we're seeing in Florida, in Texas, in Arizona, and in other states. They're not the only ones that are having a difficulty.
Why do you think he is so concerned in the coming weeks?
Well, I think that Fauci is just one of many who is concerned about how everybody is kind of feeling this loosening of restrictions around the country. Of course, everybody had those stay-at-home orders for several weeks and even into months. And now there's this sense that they've done their duty and that it's time to get on with life. It's time to go get back out and shopping. A lot of states around the country have outdoor dining. So when you walk around the United States, you're seeing kind of this loosening up, this return to so-called normal life. And it's giving people the idea that we've beaten the coronavirus when actually we're not done with that first wave yet. And all experts warn that there could be a second, even more lethal wave in the fall in tandem with our regular flu season. That's a big concern for Dr. Fauci.
And he also made some hopeful comments about a future vaccine. What did he say?
That was definitely the high point of the hearing, when Dr. Fauci described for lawmakers exactly where we are in the vaccine process. The U.S. has a lot of different options that are in development, but he singled out this one option that's going to go to trials in July, just a few weeks from now. And he said that if that has some success, then we could possibly be on track to what Dr. Fauci said earlier in the year, which was that we could have a vaccine by the end of this calendar year or the beginning of 2021. And that would really make a huge difference in all of these efforts, knowing that we really just have to get six more months until we get a vaccine.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. President Trump held a campaign rally Tuesday at a mega church in Phoenix, Arizona. Speaking to the crowd of young conservative supporters at the Dream City Church, the president lashed out at protesters who've been pulling down Confederate statues in the country that are considered a symbol of America's slavery legacy.
They're tearing down statues, desecrating monuments, and purging dissenters. It's not the behavior of a peaceful political movement. It's the behavior of totalitarians and tyrants and people that don't love our country. They don't love our country.
Trump accused demonstrators of being a, quote, left-wing mob trying to demolish. The president's comments came a day after protesters in Washington, D.C. were forcefully pushed back as they attempted to take down a statue of former President Andrew Jackson in a park across from the White House. VOA's Jason Patinkin was there and filed this report.
It's just after 8:30 p.m. outside of Lafayette Square and Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, D.C. I'm standing on the corner of Vermont and H Streets right now. There was a group of hundreds of protesters who circled around the statue of Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was the seventh president of the United States and known for his extreme brutality against Native Americans. He even had the nickname Sharp Knife because of his brutality. The protesters here who support the Black Lives Matter movement wanted to pull that statue down because they said Jackson was a racist. As they surrounded that statue and threw up chains and ropes to try to pull the statue down. Police showed up. Police confronted the protesters, and violence broke out. Police used batons. They used various chemical sprays, pepper balls. They fired pepper balls at the crowd. They used pepper spray, and there ended up being dozens, if not over 100 police to push back this crowd of protesters. Eventually, the protesters fell back from the statue. I witnessed protesters being beaten with batons. Someone was arrested and was apparently hurt. It was a mixture of police and men wearing some other kind of uniform. One of those people in uniform hit me with a baton, and he would not identify which arms group or which government agency, if any, he was with. Police near him said they did not know who he was with either. It looks now like things have calmed down a bit, but protesters have set up barricades, or they had set up barricades earlier before this attempted takedown of the statue. Now the protesters are back at the barricades. It looks like they're determined to maintain their presence here outside Lafayette Square, even if they were unable to tear down the statue of the seventh president, Andrew Jackson.
More than 200 friends and family members filed into a historic church in Atlanta, Georgia, Tuesday for the funeral of Rayshard Brooks. The death of Brooks, a black man who was shot in the back by Atlanta police outside a fast food restaurant on June 12th, heightened tensions over police brutality and racism that have raged since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, the Reverend Bernice King, spoke to mourners and said something needs to change. AP correspondent Ed Donahue has the story.
We need change, Lord. Rayshard Brooks's life matters.
Reverend King's daughter, Reverend Bernice King, says this is an all too familiar sight.
We are here because individuals continue to hide behind badges and trainings and policies and procedures, rather than regarding the humanity of others in general and black lives specifically.
Niece Gabrielle Martinez says riots aren't needed, but people helping people.
So let my Uncle Delph make us better people no matter the race. Let's treat each other how we want it to be treated as people.
I'm Ed Donahue.
In the aftermath of the deaths of African Americans like Brooks and George Floyd, the drive toward police reform seems to be heading toward the usual gridlock, with Republicans and Democrats both accusing each other of playing politics. Protests against systemic racism were sparked by the May 25th death of George Floyd while in police custody, and they have continued. In addition to calls to address hundreds of years of inequality, there has been a growing effort to enact meaningful and long-lasting police reform. Emily Owens, professor in the Department of Criminology, Law and Society at the University of California, Irvine, tells International Edition's Steve Miller via Skype
I can think of three specific ones. And I think there's been a varying amount of progress made along each of these dimensions. So the first is that, you know, police officers have a huge amount of discretion when it comes to what they do when they're on the job. And this is part because, you know, until very recently, I would say over the last 15, 20 years, even departments themselves didn't have a lot of information about what officers were doing once they, you know, finished their roll call meeting and went out into the field. What's changed is the rise of things like cameras, either in the dash of a police car or, you know, increasingly on, you know, an officer themselves that's actually providing a record of how officers are interacting with citizens. You know, if you don't know what your employees are
right,
doing.
Right, yeah. If you don't know what the problems are, you can't go around and try to fix them. And I can see how that is a huge, huge issue. So what makes it so difficult, aside from not having the background information of what the police officers are doing, to actually get meaningful reform and meaningful changes in police behavior?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so that leads to the second point, right, which is that in terms of understanding what types of policies are going to impact police behavior, you know, actually even as basic as what types of training that an officer receives either in the academy or, you know, on sort of a regular basis, there has been a surprisingly small amount of evidence on what types of training programs, for example, actually impact officer behavior in the field. And so, you know, when you mentioned consent decrees, which are something certainly, you know, in the Obama administration, the federal government was doing a lot to try to constrain or correct officer behavior when they thought individual police departments were engaged in a pattern and practice of violating civil rights. You know, the impact of consent decrees or some of the training programs that consent decrees will, you know, require agencies to put in place haven't really been evaluated in the sense that we've, you know, gone to one agency and instituted these changes and then compared what officers are doing or outcomes for that agency to another similar department.
So what was the third thing that you were mentioning?
The third point is that there is still a huge gap. And it's related to the first two. You know, there's a big gap between what a policy is and what officers are doing in the field. And just in terms of the implement, what Cynthia Lum, a colleague of mine at George Mason, just did a very sort of large study where she went to a handful of large police agencies that had implemented proactive policing policies. And she sort of figured out exactly what the policies are. And then she and her research team, you know, went on ride-alongs with police officers and sort of conducted systematic observations. And she documented a huge gap between what the policy was and what the officers were actually doing on the ground. And this is related to the discretion that police officers have.
So this brings, you know, of course, to the question that so many people around the world have. How do you bring about reform if we don't know what's worked what's worked in the past and how to get there?
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting time. You know, something that is true is that there are 18,000 local agencies that provide law enforcement in the United States. There are going to be different policies that work in different contexts depending on the community and the sort of environment that a department is working in. I don't think that any one response should be off the table, sort of dismissed offhand.
France has weathered multiple crises in recent years, terrorism, yellow vest protests, and now coronavirus. Successive governments champion the country's revolution-era moniker as the land of human rights, but critics say they don't always live by it. And that includes their response to COVID-19. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Let's see.
At issue is the 2010 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START, restricting the number of deployed nuclear warheads held by the U.S. and Russia, the world's two biggest nuclear powers. U.S. negotiator Marshall Billingsley says working group discussions may take place in late July or early August, paving the way for a possible second round of talks in Vienna.
We did indeed hold productive talks with Russia.
indeed, the talks were so productive that we found enough common ground to warrant the establishment of several technical working groups to dive further into the details of what a future trilateral arms control agreement should look like.
But there are major sticking points moving forward. Washington wants any new deal to subject China to restrictions and include all nuclear weapons, not just strategic weapons. Beijing, with an estimated fraction of the U.S. and Russian arsenal, has repeatedly refused to join the talks. The differences between Washington and Beijing were highlighted this week in clashing Twitter postings and official comments by the two sides. For its part, Russia says other nuclear powers, including France and Britain, should join future talks, but on a voluntary basis. Heading the Russian delegation, Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov also noted progress in Vienna, according to Russia's TASS news agency, but also that substantial differences remained. The discussions in the Austrian capital are the first between Moscow and Washington on their nuclear arsenals after more than a year's break. President Donald Trump has withdrawn from several U.S. treaties with Russia, including those on overflights and intermediate-range nuclear forces. The new START treaty can be extended another 5 years if both sides agree. Experts say that could pave the way for a wider-ranging and more stringent deal. Without the treaty, Washington and Moscow could be left without any significant limits on their nuclear weapons for the first time in decades. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The New York Times reports that the European Union is anxious to revive economies and proposing a plan to bar entry to Americans because the United States has failed to control the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S., which has the most coronavirus cases in the world and is experiencing a surge in new infections, would be in the same category as the number two hotspot Brazil and Russia. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has presided over a meeting of the ruling party's Central Military Commission and decided to suspend military action plans against South Korea, according to the official KCNA news agency. The video conference meeting Tuesday also discussed documents outlining measures for, quote, further bolstering the war deterrent of the country. Lawmakers in Gabon's lower house of parliament Tuesday voted to decriminalize homosexuality, becoming one of the few countries in sub-Saharan Africa to reverse a law that punishes sexual relations between people of the same sex. You're listening to International Edition. Cameroonian aid and health workers are supporting Nobel Peace Prize laureates and former heads of state calling for a COVID-19 ceasefire in the country's troubled western regions. Fighting between Cameroon's military and rebels has forced over 1,000 health and aid workers to flee, putting tens of thousands of patients at risk in the middle of a pandemic. Cameroon has so far confirmed more than 12,000 infections and 300 deaths from the virus, as Moki Edwin Kunzeka reports.
Nobel Prize laureates calling for a COVID-19 ceasefire in Cameroon include Muhammad Yunus, the Bangladeshi banker to the poor, and the former president of East Timor, Ramos Horta, and South Africa, F.W. de Klerk. They are part of a global campaign for peace and justice in Cameroon, which on Monday urged the United Nations Security Council and the African Union to push for an end to the fighting. The group of 15, which includes three former U.S. ambassadors to Cameroon, wants a truce between the military and Anglophone rebels in the troubled western regions so health workers can safely stop the virus. Cameroon's health workers, hundreds of whom have fled insecurity in the region, welcomed the high-profile support. Director of the Cameroon Baptist Convention of Churches Health Services, T. Pius, spoke via a messaging application from the northwestern town of Bamenda.
The COVID-19 has even placed a more serious problem now on the population, because you need to identify these cases quickly, isolate them, and treat those that you can treat, and while preventing more infections in the community. We are unable to reach out to do this. Workers are afraid when they see all these arms by the government or by the non-government armed groups.
Pius says four of their health workers were abducted in the region on Monday. Tanya Christian Eselekwe is with the Cameroon branch of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Foundation, a U.S. group providing aid to the troubled region. He says the foundation's services were disrupted in May when armed groups abducted his staff and stole vehicles transporting humanitarian supplies. He also spoke via a messaging app from Bamenda.
Our plea is that there is the need for ceasefire to allow those who are affected by the crisis to receive the needed assistance. As humanitarian organizations, we work strictly based on the humanitarian principles and the international humanitarian law. We do not take sides, and we make sure that all our operations are geared towards relieving the suffering of those affected by this crisis.
On social media, Cameroon Anglophone rebel groups who want independence from Francophone-majority Cameroon had mixed reactions to the ceasefire call. The Anglophone Defense Forces, ADF, said it supported a truce but warned that it would retaliate if provoked by Cameroon's military. The Southern Cameroon Defense Forces had some members supporting a break, while others called for continuing to fight for independence until the government withdraws troops. Cameroon's military has indicated it would continue raids on separatist strongholds, which last week killed 24 rebels in the English-speaking northwest. Cameroon government spokesman René Emmanuel Sadi said they would comment on the calls for a ceasefire at what he called an appropriate moment. The UN says Cameroon's separatist conflict has left more than 3,000 people dead and displaced more than 500,000 in 4 years of fighting. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The now retired German Otto Pfister has one of the proudest coaching pedigrees in African football history. The 82-year-old Pfister coached more than half a dozen African national teams, including Ghana. In Accra, filed this report on Pfister's coaching legacy, which includes guiding Ghana to the FIFA U-17 world title in 1991. Kwabena Ofori in Accra filed this report on Pfister's coaching legacy, which includes guiding Ghana to the FIFA U-17 world title in 1991.
The 82-year-old retired German coach led Ghana's under-17 team to win the FIFA 1991 Youth World Cup in Italy when Ghana beat Spain 1-0 on August 31st in Florence. 5 months after his World Cup achievement with the Black Stars, and in January 1992, the German tactician led the senior national team of Ghana, the Black Stars, captained by Abedi Pele, to the 1992 Senegal African Cup of Nations, rated as one of the best tournaments, but lost to Ivory Coast in the final after 120 minutes without a winner when the game went into penalty shootout, which ended 11 goals to 10 for the Ivorians. Retired coach Otto Pfister started coaching in Africa with Rwanda in 1972 at an early age of 35. Other African national teams he managed were Burkina Faso, then Upper Volta, Senegal, Ivory Coast, Zaire, Togo, and Cameroon. Coach Otto Pfister, the longest serving coach in Africa, in an interview with City News in Accra from his German home, sent a piece of advice to the Black Stars head coach, C.K. Akono.
He has to be permanent in contact with the coaches in Europe, in France, in Germany, in England. And that is not easy for a coach. He has experience. He play in Fortuna Cologne. He play in Wolfsburg. He play in Germany. He has this professional know-how. But you have to give him free hands. You know, in Ghana, sometimes people like going into the lecture. I remember when I selected the squad, Scarlets 91, because in the last minute I put Sami Ufo inside. And then some people from Accra tell me, no, 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 it's not possible. He's very young. I fight even with one journalist. I take him in, and then after this, he can be a big player in Germany, you know? He have to be free from this. He have to realize his own idea.
The German coach who served past 3 decades in Africa said, shifting the African Cup of Nations from early January to summer by CAF is not a good idea.
In January, February is always more better for Africa, like in June, you know. I don't know who can this idea place to the Africa Cup of Nations in June. I think it's okay in December, January, February, in this time. It's a political decision, but I can't tell you for this.
That was 82-year-old retired German coach Otto Pfister, Kwabnofori in Accra.
In Washington, D.C., several weeks of heated demonstrations calling for racial justice and equality left behind signs, posters, and other artwork of value to historians. The National Museum of African American History and Culture and several other Smithsonian institutions have been trying to collect and preserve the materials. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
They protested day after day because of the death of George Floyd, a black man who died in late May after being in police custody in the state of Minnesota. Demonstrators attached hundreds of posters and artwork to a temporary fence near the White House to express themselves.
Pain and struggle oftentimes inspires some of the best art, and all these people are putting their thoughts, emotions, their recognition of this time in these little pieces, these little posters.
As word got out that the fence would be taken down, city workers and volunteers swooped in to gather up the items left behind and move them to a wall across the street for safekeeping.
When we first approached, we were surprised that we didn't see any signs on the fence as we did on television. And as we were further down, we could see that all of the signs were still here and preserved. And we're thankful for that because we still have the opportunity to see it.
The Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington has created a rapid response collecting team. Its goal? To document the social protests held across the country and around the world, sparked by Floyd's death and other alleged cases of police brutality, says curator Aaron Bryant.
Behind those artifacts are real voices, real lived experiences, and a humanity that we can all connect to.
No justice, no peace.
The museum's hope is to use this opportunity to have an honest dialogue about race.
Right now, in this very transformative period in our nation's history, we should require, and I would say demand, honest conversations around the unvarnished truth. It's the only way that we can progress as a collective humanity.
I hope to see this collage as a section in the Smithsonian National African American Museum someday.
Literally signs of the time as keepsakes of history. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
And finally today, more than 300 black actors and filmmakers, including Idris Elba, Queen Latifah, and Billy Porter, have been asking Hollywood to divest in the police and invest in anti-racist content. They sent an open letter addressed to, quote, our allies in Hollywood, which attacked what it called the industry's legacy of white supremacy and said Hollywood encourages the epidemic of police violence and culture of anti-blackness. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.